This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast. Hello, welcome to Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. I'm your host, Claire, and we've got an important mission this month. It is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and we're shedding light on a crucial issue. Brain tumors claim more lives among children and adults under 40 than any other cancer. Shockingly, only 1% of the national spend on cancer research is allocated to this silent threat. Because today, right here on Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show, we're taking a stand. We're not just talking statistics. We're sharing stories, real heartfelt stories from people all around the globe who have been touched by a brain tumor. It's time to raise our voices and spread the word. By listening in, you're joining a movement to make a difference.
Hello.
Hi, Grace.
Hi there, Claire. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much that you're taking the time to share your experience and being a part of Brain Tumor Awareness Month.
Of course. No worries. Happy to chat about it and help.
Should we go back to when you were originally feeling some symptoms that then led up to your diagnosis?
Okay, so it was early 2014. I was at uni. I was in my third year. I only had a few months left, few assignments left to hand in. And I started experiencing weird physical symptoms. I'm always really keen to highlight I had no headaches and no loss of vision, which are the two most common symptoms. And I don't even know if they're the most common. I think they're just the ones that people expect. I had none of that. I had the right-hand side of my body over the course of about 4 or 5 months stopped working properly. So my arm, my hand and my arm on my right-hand side started twitching. I lost use of my right hand effectively. Very suddenly, I couldn't handwrite anymore. I couldn't hold anything without dropping it. My arm was twitching every which way, completely independently of me. It was a bit strange. And then as time went on, that got worse. My shoulder started turning back and forth quite independently. I eventually started losing balance. I would fall over quite a lot. I became very clumsy, which is quite unlike me. And my partner at the time, actually, who I think I'd only been with him for a few months, poor thing, he was having to hold on to me as we walked places because I would just fall over. And also my perception was a bit off. So I wasn't just falling over, but my perception wasn't very good. I would be walking in a straight line, what I thought was a straight line down the road or down a corridor or whatever, and I would veer off, usually to the right-hand side. I noticed that everything was happening on the right-hand side, and I would walk into walls quite a lot or doorways, which I'm still not 100% on. I often find that if I don't really properly think about it and focus, I do often walk into doorways. So I think that's just a little quirk that I've developed over the years from that. But generally, much better now, obviously. And I also found it came up to the Easter kind of period, the right-hand side of my face. So I'm losing balance. I'm clumsy. I can't use my right hand. I've adapted as best I can. I wrote my entire creative writing dissertation with my left hand.
Wow.
Because I couldn't. I started wearing my bag on my left-hand side and just using my left hand just as the prominent hand because the other one was pretty useless.
Did you go to your GP and tell them about this, or were you just trying to deal with it?
Do you know, for quite a while, I was just dealing with it. I think looking back, I can't really describe it. I had a feeling that it was a big deal and I didn't have time to deal with it there and then. I was thinking, I was putting my lecturers should have appreciated, I was putting my degree, my work and everything first. I think I was very misguided about it. I was saying, I've got a job, I've got my degree, I've got to hand in all these assignments and do, I had a couple of drama performances to do and the creative writing dissertation and all that jazz. And I was like, I'll deal with it once all of that's over, when I've got some free time. But also I wasn't around my parents, obviously, because I was living like 3 hours away at uni. So they weren't seeing me day to day. I think if I'd been living with them at the time and they'd seen how much I was struggling physically, then they probably would have intervened and said, go to the doctor, please.
Yeah.
Also, it got to the point where over the Easter period, the right side of my face started slumping, almost like I'd had a stroke, and the right-hand side of my mouth stopped working. So I started talking out the left side of my mouth. Again, it's incredible how the body just adapts, and mentally as well. I was like, that doesn't work anymore. I'll just do this instead. And eventually, once I'd handed in all my assignments, I had a performance that my parents actually came along to. And they watched me on stage and they saw me twitching quite considerably on stage. And they said afterwards, "You were fantastic, but what's that about? Go see someone about it, please." As I expected they would. And then, so I waited until all of that was done, went to the GP, and it was the classic kind of story where I had to go a few times and I had to see lots of different individuals to be taken seriously, unfortunately. My GP, I don't blame them at all, but she was seen quite, I don't know how to put it, actually. It sounds really mean. She seemed quite jaded, quite fed up, I felt, because it was primarily a student client base that they had. Maybe she saw a lot of people struggling or not taking their health seriously. I don't know. But I don't blame her at all, but she said, "You're in your third year of uni. You've got a lot of assignments due. You're probably stressed, and that's why your body's stopped working." And then she said, "Or maybe you're going out and drinking too much." And I knew that wasn't true because in my third year, obviously, all the focus was on work. So I wasn't actually socializing that much or going out any at all. It did require a lot of pushing. I think my GP agreed to send me for an X-ray of my arm because I said, "My arm's twitching. That's not normal." So she sent me to hospital, probably to chop me up. She sent me to the hospital. I had an X-ray. They were very lovely there. And they said, "Nope, nothing wrong with your arm." But do you know what was really bizarre was, and now that I know how hospitals work more, because at that point I'd never really been to hospital. I'd never broken a bone or had anything serious happen to me. So I didn't really get how it worked. But after they gave me the X-ray, they said, "We're going to do an MRI on your arm." There and then, that same day, they said, "We'll put you in the MRI machine." And so I went in, and that's very rare. So I don't know what happened there. But I went in and had the MRI. And obviously, I'm sure this, you have to stay still in the MRI machine. And I couldn't do that. I was twitching. Yeah. So I twitched the whole scan. And eventually they radioed through and said, "We're going to have to do another one because that one you twitched too much." And I said, "But that's my problem."
Yeah.
So I was in there for the better part of an hour just so they could get a good measure of what was happening. Then I hung around in the A&E kind of area of waiting for these results. And then I saw a doctor at the hospital and he said, "We can't see anything wrong." And I think that was the point where I broke down a bit and cried and said, "Nope, there's something really wrong. Yeah. I need to see someone.
Yeah.
It's not my arm. It's my whole body." And eventually he was very good. He listened. He took it on and he said, "It sounds like a neurological thing. Let's send you to a neurologist," which was a month later. I had an appointment with a neurologist. Obviously, condition had got worse by then. And he did loads of funny little tests. He got me to write a nursery rhyme on a piece of paper with my right hand, which obviously I couldn't really do. He got me to touch all my fingers to my thumb on my right hand, which was quite alarming because I couldn't do that either. He got me to walk down a corridor, and I did, and I walked into the wall. And then he got me to hold my arms out in front of me and count down from 100. So all sorts of funny neurological tests I had to do. And I didn't do very well at any of them, really. He eventually came to the conclusion that it was my contraceptive pill. And he said, "You're on a contraceptive pill. Come off that. Your symptoms will lessen.
They did that to me.
Did they?
They went, "Oh, and they said it must be your contraceptive pill. And I was like, "It's not that, it's more, but okay." And oh, that really bugs me because that just seems to be the go-to. They're stressed. Okay, they're just being over, like faffing around because they're young. And oh, she must be pregnant. Or oh, she's obviously just got hormonal issues. And it's so annoying.
And you feel so, and it was so frustrating because I remember when I told him that I was on the contraceptive pill, I saw his face go, "Oh, that must be it." And it was almost like he didn't need to look any further.
Yeah.
And I was, he said, "You've been on it too long, take a break." I said, "It's only been about 3 or 4 years. It's not that long." So I came off that. So obviously then with all my pre-existing symptoms, I then had the trauma to my body of coming off the contraceptive pill, which isn't very fun at all hormonally. But also it was a crystallizing moment. And I says to everyone, it was quite strange how, as I was leaving his office, I put my hand on the doorknob and I heard him behind me say, "Actually, let's put you in for an MRI of the brain just so we can have a look and rule that out."
Oh, thank goodness.
And I said, "What do you?" I know. And he said, "This isn't usually how a brain tumor presents itself, but it's worth a look." And I went, "Okay, great." And he said, "We'll be in touch. We'll send you a letter." And all I heard was brain tumor. And I went out to my then boyfriend waiting for me in the waiting area. And I said, "I think he thinks I have a tumor." And it was so funny because it was like an afterthought for him. He just casually mentioned it as I left the room. But maybe he did it that way because he didn't want to freak me out. I don't know. But it was almost like he just thought, yeah, we might as well. Let's do that. And then another month later, I had the brain MRI. It was at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's nearly 10 years ago now, on the 27th of May. And I went in there and it was a very interesting experience because nobody tells you these things about MRIs. They're loud. They're really loud. Like everyone says, oh, they're claustrophobic. I'm fine with the claustrophobia. I'm quite fortunate. I don't mind being in a small confined space. But it was the noise and the shock to the system that created that really affected me.
Yeah.
I used to cry in MRIs for years. I used to cry. These days, I'm very zen. I have one every year and I actually have a nap while I'm in there, which is great.
Yeah, it sounds like you're going past a building site or something and they're using a digger or something and you can just hear. Yeah, it's not very nice. It's so loud.
Yeah, a digger on like a train or, I don't know, like a siren going off. It's awful. So I was in there and I was having an experience and they played some music for me, luckily. But what was really bizarre was at one point I opened my eyes and looked out. And obviously, when you're having your head examined, you have a frame around your head with a mirror attached so you can see out. Mm. Really helpful for me. So I looked in this mirror and I saw in the next room, just at the end of the sort of bed, as it were, I saw the healthcare assistants, nurses, whoever, were all crowded around the screen in the next room, pointing at it. And I thought, oh, that's a bit strange, because I remember from my arm one, they were just sitting in there like it was perfectly normal. Okay. You could see they were all peering around and going, that. And I wasn't alarmed, which was quite strange as well. I thought, oh, they found something. Okay, good. Because at that point, it had been best part of 6 months that I'd been had these symptoms. And it had been about 3 months that I'd been going back and forth to my GP to the hospital. So I thought, I'm actually quite relieved. And when I left, my dad was in the waiting area. He very kindly come over from Sussex to take me to the hospital that day because I said it was quite a horrible experience the first time around on my own.
Yeah.
And he said, all right, how was that? And I said, they found something. Obviously, they couldn't tell me as I left. I said, did you see anything? And they said, we'll be in touch. We'll give you a call. I was like, okay. And dad said, so you're sure they saw something? I said, yep, they were all crowded around the screen pointing. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go to London for the day because my dad had to go to work in London. So I said, I'll come with you and I'll just amuse myself for the day because I know they'll be in touch soon.
Which hospital were you at?
So I walked around London. This was the Winchester General, I think it's called. Royal Hampshire County or something like that. I'll have to look it up.
And you went all the way to London from there?
Yeah, do you know what? From Winchester, it's quite speedy, an hour. But I just wanted the distraction. Yeah. I didn't want to go home. I wanted to have a potter around. I think also on some level, I knew that things were going to change quite soon. And maybe I wanted to enjoy whatever freedom I could find in the meantime.
Yeah.
And so I walked around London for 10 hours by myself, just wandered around, went into shops, I went to a couple of art galleries, things like that. I was just like, oh, just distracting myself. And then that evening I had dinner with my family in London. Coincidentally, we were all getting together with some friends. And then I went back to Winchester where I was living and my family went home to Sussex. And then the next day this was a bit of a low point actually, because for some reason, even though I was nearly 20 years old, the hospital called my parents instead of me. They had my number. They had my contact information. They knew that I wasn't living with them, but they called my parents and said, we found a mass on her brain. We need to see her. She needs to come into the clinic. And that then obviously put my parents in a really horrible position because my dad then had to call me and say, I need you to come home, come and meet me in London and we'll travel home together because he had to go to work that day. And another kind of key point in my story, actually, my friends who I was with at the time, they all bundled into the car and drove me to the station, went into Waterloo. And I sat with dad. I don't know if you've ever been to Waterloo Station, but you know, on the mezzanine level, the Benugo, they do very good coffee. They're really lovely staff. I always go there whenever I'm going through Waterloo. It's a thing for me, actually. Even if I don't really want anything, I'll go there and get a coffee or something because it's an important place for me. Dad sat with me on the mezzanine and he was really upset. Obviously, he was trying not to cry. And he said, they found something. You were right. They found a mass. And you have a clinic appointment tomorrow, but you need to come home tonight. I was like, okay.
Must have been just...
And then went home.
That must have been so awful for both of you. Oh. That makes me feel
sick. I felt terrible.
Yeah, I feel sick for you like that. No. But your stomach must have just dropped. Horrible.
Yeah, and I think because I could see how upset Dad was, a part of me thought, I've got to crack on and not be too sad. We had a cry and a cuddle. It was lovely. But I was like, okay. And straight away, I was like, how can we make this a more positive thing? And obviously got up into Mum and she was very upset and we all had a bit of a weep. And then, but we were quite the same, actually. We were like, we're going to clinic appointment tomorrow. Let's sort this out. Let's see what they say. So that was the 28th of May. And I was in Hurstwood Park Neurological Center having a craniotomy on the 6th of June. So it was a very quick turnaround. I had about barely even 10 days at home. And I just tried to cram in as many friends or whatever who I could see in the meantime and have a bit of fun and go for days out with my family. And we met my neurosurgeon halfway through that time. And then, I was in. They bumped me right up to the top of the queue because it was quite urgent. They were saying, so to begin with, they just said it's a mass. When we met my neurosurgeon, he said, we don't know what it is. He was great. He's my hero. He just sat me down and said, I'm going to be honest. We don't know what it is. We don't know what we're dealing with. We're just going to have to go in and see what comes up kind of thing. And so it was very honest, very transparent. And we went, all right. And the surgery was over 10 hours. And then I had my histology report about a week or two later. My parents would tell you the exact dates, but I don't remember. It was all a bit of a blur. And they said, it's a pilocytic astrocytoma. It's between the brainstem and the cerebellum, which is a very unusual place because it's low grade. So it's grade one. And it had been growing, they reckon, for about 15 years. And it had two cysts attached to it. So the reason that I'd been experiencing my symptoms was because the cysts, there were two of them that were attached to this tumor that had been with me since I was about 5 years old, apparently. The cysts had been bumping up against different parts of my brain in my left temporal lobe. So obviously the left side of the brain controlling the right side of the body, that's why the right side of my body had stopped working because these cysts were getting in the way of the messaging. They drained the cysts. I didn't have to have a shunt or anything, but they sorted that out then and there. And removed as much as they could because they said, even though it's low grade, so they don't say benign or malignant, they say it's low grade. They grade it 1 to 4, mine is a 1. And they said, but it's in a really inconvenient and very strange place. And my surgeon has since told me he reckons that I'm one of 100 people in the whole world who's got exactly that kind of thing, that situation, that low grade in that particular place.
You must have felt really special.
Like, oh, I did. When he said that recently, it wasn't too long ago, actually. It was only a few years ago. He said, I reckon that you're quite unique, one of 100. And I went, well, that's quite cool. But at the time, when I had the histology results, they said, if you have to have a tumor, this is the one you want to get because it's quite low key. It's not going to cause much trouble. But for you, unfortunately, it's in an inconvenient place.
Yeah.
And they had to leave a little bit behind because they said it would be too dangerous to remove it all. We could touch the brainstem. We don't want to do that. Then I'd recovered and got on with life.
Were you having any of the balance issues or were you feeling pretty good?
So it was funny, actually. So it was the 6th of June, I had the surgery. The 10th of June was my grandma's birthday. And they all came into hospital. My family all came into hospital to have a few cake and celebrate with her. We were making the best of it, bless her. And my mum came in and she gave me a birthday card to sign for grandma. She said, here you go, just put that in. Without even thinking, I opened the card and I just wrote a little message and signed my name and then gave it back to my mum. And as soon as I did that, then I looked down at my hand and went, oh my God, it works. And I hadn't been able to handwrite.
Oh.
Yeah, I got my writing back. I hadn't been able to handwrite for 6 months. And then suddenly, just without even thinking, I'd just done it.
Did you think that was going to happen? Did they say to you, you may get more kind of movement on that side and being able to do things? Or was that a bit of a shock? And you were like, oh, okay.
It was a bit of a shock. As I remember, it was a bit of a shock. They didn't promise me anything. They said, this will help your symptoms. We will do our best and hopefully it'll alleviate them completely.
Oh, great.
But my surgeon, he's very direct. He's brilliant. He said, oh yeah, you'll be fine. Like it was the even questioning it was silly. He said, no, you'll be fine. It'll fix it. It'll fix it straight away. You'll be completely back to normal. And I was asking things like silly questions, though not really silly, but at the time I felt silly asking them. I was asking, will it affect my mind? Will it affect my personality? Will it make me behave differently having an invasive surgery? And he said, no, you'll be fine. And even after a few days in the hospital, I was recovering and on various types of painkillers for a few days. which is quite nice. He came in and said, he came and visited me in the ward and said, have you got up for a walk yet? And I said, only to the bathroom. And he said, come on then, get up, go for a walk. Like, he was very encouraging in his way.
Yeah, hurry up, get up.
And he said, you're fine.
Hurry up.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Need the babe.
And he said, you're fine. That was probably the case, actually. And he said, you can, and they were very lovely. They said, you can go home. You'll do your best recovery at home. That's the universal truth. I would say my balance still wasn't 100%, but it was much, much better. And everything else was just completely fine. As soon as my swelling went down around, my face was back to normal, wasn't slumpy anymore. I wasn't twitching. And when the cysts reinflated and the tumor grew back a little bit, 9 months later, the first signs were not twitching, but I was struggling to hold things again suddenly. Just ever so slightly, but enough to this. And I was suddenly feeling a bit clumsy again. And those were the warning signs. And by that point, I'd learned that you say something straight away. So I was quite trigger happy with my doctor. I went straight to the GP and said, I'm having these symptoms again. Mm. And I got in touch with my neurosurgeon's secretary and said, can I have an MRI, please? And they did. And sure enough, they said, yep, we have to go in again, unfortunately. And then I had radiotherapy after that second operation. I was sent to the Royal Marsden in Sutton, and I had 6 weeks of quite intense tapping. Mm. And since then, touch wood, it's remained quite stable, because obviously they still can't remove it all. There's still a little bit left.
Did you feel there was more problems after the second time, or actually it was very similar?
Funny you ask. The second one was harder. Recovery was much harder. I was very sick for the first few weeks. I was getting very nauseous, had a lot of pain in my head, because obviously they had to reopen the same scar. So that obviously caused a lot of pain. And I was finding, I was very dizzy. I was very nauseous. I had a very strange situation where basically in the second op, some of my temporalis muscle on the left side of my head had slipped slightly when they stitched me back up. So there was a bit of a gap where there was no kind of muscle protecting between the skin and the skull. Yeah. I know there's a lot more to it than that. They dumbed it down for me considerably. That's my understanding of it. And there was a hole in my skull. So I do have a couple of screws in my skull, which is quite fun. I get people to feel them sometimes to freak people out. But there was a hole, and through that hole, some cerebral spinal fluid leaked through. So I had almost like a water balloon on my face for a few months. So on my forehead, the top left corner of my forehead, I just had this big blob poking out from under my fringe. And it was squishy, so you could touch it and it would squish like a water balloon, which was quite disconcerting. And it was just like that for a while. I tried to have it drained, but obviously they couldn't completely because there was still the hole. And they said, we've just got to wait for it to close up. And I couldn't have radio until that hole had closed and my face was back to its normal shape, because they had to fit a mask. So they said, we're going to hold off until your face is reduced swelling and everything. But I then had one more surgery in 2018, but it wasn't a craniotomy. It was a repair job on my slipped muscle. And that was a cosmetic procedure. I reluctantly say cosmetic because it makes it sound like a vanity project, but it was my surgeon's idea. So when he saw me in 2018, it was 2017 actually, because I was waiting for a year to have it done and I couldn't work in that time, not full time anyway. And my surgeon looked at me and said, Grace, I'm not happy. He said, I'm not happy with your face. Are you happy with your face? And I said, oh, it's fine. And I said, you know what? And you'll relate to this. I said, oh, the important thing is that I'm okay. I'm healthy. I'm alive. All that.
Yeah.
And he said, yes, but are you happy with the way you look? And I said, it's not important. The important thing is I'm healthy. I'm happy. It's all good. I'm carrying on. I can go back to work soon and all this. And he said, are you happy with your face? And he said it the third time. And I said, actually, no. And then I got really emotional because I didn't want to admit it, but I was very self-conscious because it was bulging on the side of my head. So the swelling from the fluid had gone down, but the leftover crevice, almost I would call it, in the top left corner of my face/head was quite noticeable. And then I had the bulk of the muscle on the left-hand side protruding just underneath it on the side of my head. And I'd had my mum's hairdresser was very kind. She was cutting my hair to hide it. So she was giving me a big old fringe on one side, and I was managing it. But my surgeon said,
it doesn't look quite right now. It's my fault. The muscle slipped in the operation. I want to fix it. And he said, also, it's only going to get worse as you get older and it will protrude even more and the gap will look a bit more noticeable and you won't always be able to hide it. I think he took it quite personally because he was a bit of a perfectionist. Oh. I would hope so as a surgeon. But I think he felt like it wasn't fair on me. And I think he wanted to do right by me and sort it out if he had the power to. And I'm very grateful he put me in touch with some cosmetic surgeons at the Queen Victoria in East Grinstead. I still go there once a year for checkups and they give me nice little tree Botox injections to keep the swelling managed. And I had the two cosmetic surgeons at that hospital and my neurosurgeon working on me on fixing that in my face in September 2018. And that was the last surgery to the head anyway. I've had a couple of others, but it was good actually, because that felt like the final chapter, because all the while I was waiting for that surgery, it felt like the whole thing was unfinished. It was the end of it. And they said, we really don't want to ever have to open your head up again, please.
How often do you go and have MRIs now?
In with it was every 3 months and then went down to every 6 months. And now it's one every year. So it's an annual thing and it's my choice when they do it, because it used to be when it was 6 months, it would be one at Christmas and one in the spring. And after, you know, a while, they said you can go down to one per year now if you want to. And they were very open. They said, if you want to keep coming every 6 months just for your own personal reassurance, that's absolutely fine. But if we take it down to one per year, you know, we're quite comfortable to do that. And I said, yep, let's do that. But can it please be the springtime one, because I have this weird thing in my life where every time I've got seriously ill, because I've had a couple of other things happen to me, it's been around April, May and June kind of time every time. So for a few years, I would get very anxious when that time of year came around, because I would think it's going to go wrong this year. But when I started having the annual scans, I said, if there's a scan in place, end of May, beginning of June every year, that is going to really help me mentally just feel more comfortable and more safe. And they said, absolutely, no problem. And the last time I went, so last June, they said, we can even now take you down to 2 years if you really want. It's not, you've been stable for long enough now that we feel comfortable to do that. But my surgeon actually said, he said, it's completely up to you. If you want to come every 6 months, if you even want to go back to every 3 months, we will do that for you. We really don't mind, like whatever you need to feel confident and comfortable in yourself. And he said, also, it would be a shame making it every 2 years because I enjoy it when you and your parents visit.
Aww.
If you're like, I know. And I said, let's keep it to one per year for now. And I also said, because next year, this year, will be a 10-year anniversary of the first craniotomy, the first MRI, first craniotomy, all that jazz. And I said, so I'd like at least one this particular year. And then we'll see where we go from there.
How are you feeling about the whole thing? Have you found you needed support at the beginning, or have you found that family support has been more than enough?
Oh, interesting. So my mindset from the get-go was very much, right, let's be positive. Let's make the best of it. I was quite gung-ho about it. And people were quite shocked by how cheery and positive. I was very well supported by my family and my then boyfriend and my friends. They were all wonderful, always there for me. I did have to say to my parents, actually, the way into the time between diagnosis and surgery, my parents and my grandparents both said, we would take this from you if we could, and we would go through this. Like, I wish it was me. And I had to stop them saying that after a while, because they did say it a few times. And I said, please stop saying that, because I don't wish it was you. I actually said my whole philosophy, I don't know where it came from, but I just had this overwhelming feeling of, as long as it's me, it's okay. Because I say, if it's me, it can't happen to anyone else. If it's me, I'm taking one for the team. And if it's me, it won't be one of my parents, one of my grandparents, my sister, anyone who, if it was any of them and I had to sit on the sidelines and watch them go through it and not be able to do anything on my end and help, I would feel awful. I would felt so much worse. And I said, but as long as it's me, it's fine. I said, also, I had the easiest part of the job. I just have to go in, fall asleep. They have a little tinker in my head and it'll be fine. But it was only after the second operation, I think it was. Well, I started seeing a therapist somewhere between the first and second op. So I was seeing her when I was told I needed more surgery. So I was able to go into my next session and tell her my news. So that was very helpful. But I still don't think it had properly landed by then. So I think I was going through the motions in therapy, talking to this counselor, but it hadn't really hit me yet. And it was only a couple of years later that it really caught up with me and I settled and thought, oh my goodness, that was a big thing. That was a big deal. And it was, yeah, quite horrifying, quite depressing. I went into a bit of a hole with it, almost like a, I have been diagnosed with PTSD much further down the line with some other surgeries that I've had to have. But it was like that. It was a little bit like that when it all, yeah, when it all catches up with you as soon as you stop and you don't have to be positive and you don't have to be making everyone feel better. Because that was something I really hated. I hated that people were worrying about me. I really didn't like how sad I was making people were turning up on our doorstep with gifts and cards and crying on me and all this. And I was like, hey, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. So I didn't want anyone else to be upset.
It's true what you say, though, is things happen at different stages. Like, you don't necessarily need all the counselling at one time because you're dealing with it in a different way and you're not finding it very helpful. But I always think it, if people can go and see somebody, go and see someone. And if it doesn't work, go and see somebody else, because it does work to talk about it. Otherwise, it sits in your mind and you still realise that you're quite traumatised. It's a horrible thing to go through. Everything you have to deal with. It's not nice at all. And anyone with the most amount of confidence, it rocks your confidence. But you can get back to yourself. You can absolutely get yourself back to yourself. But you do have to acknowledge that something needs to be talked out a little bit and then discuss it and then maybe be able to move on a bit. But I think we all try and shut it down and think, oh, we can deal with this and oh, it's fine and we'll be all right. And then later you're like, gosh, it like you say, it catches up on you a little bit.
Yes, for sure. Definitely. I think when it did eventually catch up with me and I started seeing a different counselor, the counselor I saw first of all was great, but yeah, I wasn't mentally ready to open up completely, talk about it. It hadn't hit me yet. Yeah. And I say to everyone, oh my goodness, even if you don't have it to go through anything as intense as this, go see, even if you, it's a long process, obviously, if you go via your GP or whatever, but you, there are certain mental health organizations, counseling sort of services where you can refer yourself and some might even pay what you can and you can sign up for like 10 to 12 weeks and just have a little MOT of your mind and have a look and see what's going on. The best investment you can.
Yeah, there is actually charities like brain tumor charities that they will get you to have neuropsychiatrists and to go and speak to them and you don't pay for that. They do it through the charity donations that they get.
That's true.
I don't think everyone. I didn't know about that, but then it was also, mine was 2008.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, you can go through charities. It's quite easy. And your family as well, people who have gone through these things with you, I think they can consult with the charity as well. I've been so lucky. And again, I can't imagine how alienating it must have been to go through that in a time with no sort of social media and no community kind of support. That must have been really hard. Also, it's not talked about. It's a bit of a grey area in the middle there. And I remember finding this out when I was in hospital and having my treatments. And then when I work a lot with the brain tumour charity, they were kind enough to get in touch with me when I was going through it. Because funnily enough, I had a friend. So a friend's then girlfriend worked at the charity and they sent me a care package. They reached out, they got in touch. And then suddenly they were, I think that year they were on Children in Need, I think. And I saw that. And I started corresponding with them and getting more information from them, which was so helpful. But I remember thinking when I was in hospital being treated both times, I was the youngest person on the ward. It was all old ladies on my ward. And it was very strange. I didn't feel like I belonged there really.
Yeah.
I loved the hospital, which is a weird thing to say, but it was a really nice hospital. It was quite quiet, very peaceful, quite small. And everyone was wonderful. But yeah, I felt very strange being the youngest person there. And since then, I've obviously found out all kinds of truths. Like I said about the age groups, it's the biggest cancer killer of people under the age of 40, but it most commonly happens in children under the age of 10. But also the crazy stats, like the average person will go to their GP 3 times before they get the right test done for a brain tumor.
Yeah.
Things like that, which I really identify with for sure. But going back to the therapy thing, I'm still talking about it to this day in therapy. I've been stable for however many years, but it still comes up and it still affects me in the long term, for sure. Like my biggest thing, I don't know if you have this at all, my biggest thing is every time things are going well and I've got a few sort of exciting things happening and I've booked a holiday in a year's time, or I've got an exciting kind of concert or something I'm going to. This summer I'm going to see Taylor Swift, obviously. As soon as I've got exciting future plans, I think, yeah, this kind of nice period, it won't last. Something will come up, something will ruin it. I have to cancel my holiday. I'll have to do this and that. I'll be put back in hospital. I really, for a long time, I'm getting over it a bit now, but for a long time, it was almost like getting hit over the head so many times that I started to duck and I started to get scared of booking anything or looking ahead to the future, because I knew how very likely it was that everything could change in a second. And I know I'm not the only one. I've spoken to a lot of people who have gone through any kind of cancer experience or health scare, and it's very much the same.
But you clearly are taking opportunities, because you wouldn't have done a TED talk. You wouldn't be doing what you're doing. So you are taking opportunities that you would never have done had this not have happened to you.
No, definitely not. My degree was in drama and creative writing. So I was happy to do like performances, for instance. I do that, but I never would have thought about doing any kind of keynote speech or anything like that, like speaking on my own on stage to a crowded room.
Yeah.
That would have horrified. Yeah, for sure. I think it does. It teaches you a lot of things, and it definitely teaches you to make the most of opportunities. And also I think I'll take any opportunity to speak about my journey with my health, all the things that have happened to me. And mental health as well. It's so important to raise awareness for how you can be affected in many ways.
If there was a charity or organization, or there was somewhere and they are looking for someone to come and inspire people with someone like yourself, with your story, how can they get hold of you?
Oh, I'm on Instagram @_GraceLatter, all one word. And I also have a blog, almostamazinggrace.com. And yeah, all my contact info is on there. Or you can just ask the Brain Tumor Charity, because they know how to get hold of me as well.
Is there anything else you want us to talk about? Is there anything you want us to mention?
Yeah. What was my overwhelming message is, you know, go to therapy, look out for yourself. Also, if I'm allowed, I will be doing the Brain Tumor Charity's Twilight Walk. On the 23rd of March with my family and some of my closest friends and my partner as well. And we'll be raising money for that. And that's like on JustGiving. You can search for me or for my mum, Deborah Latter. She has the page. But also I'd say if anyone identifies with this or has been affected by a brain tumor, come along to the Twilight Walk. It is the loveliest, happiest thing. It really is the epitome of the community. It's so beautiful, and there are so many wonderful, cheery, happy people. I have a friend who I've, unfortunately, in my journey with the charity and with my experiences, I have lost a few friends that I've made along the way. A couple of people have passed away, and I've got one who's very near now, unfortunately. But I had one who passed away last year, and her husband came along to the Twilight Walk on his own, and it was quite soon after she'd passed away, and he was very emotional. But the charity were just like supporting him, propping him up all day, and everyone was walking along with him and hugging him and stuff. It was lovely. It was a beautiful experience.
I did the Twilight Walk with my mum. I did the Windsor one with my mum.
Oh, really?
I was still a bit unstable on my legs. They were a bit weak. So my mum did it, and I just was having a coffee, following her around occasionally and meeting her at different checkpoints and watched her doing it with some others. Yeah, and so she loved it. She said it was just such a good feeling.
My family and I have done it. I think we've done 6 Twilight Walks now, obviously not during the pandemic, but we've done it differently every time. We've been volunteers a couple of years. My parents are usually like standing at the checkpoints or will walk. I was a young ambassador for the charity one year, so I was answering questions and chatting to people at the check-in, and then did the walk with my fellow young ambassadors. And yeah, it's just such a lovely, joyous experience. And every year I try and take a different group of people and introduce more people to it.
Yeah. No, it's a really nice evening. And it's just, everyone's chatting away. Some people are talking about brain tumors, some are not. They're talking about something else. And yeah, it's just a really nice feeling. And yeah, and it is really peaceful there as well around that time when they do it. It's not like too busy. So it's quite a calming route, isn't it? It's really nice. And hoping that there's good weather for you all, because then you get an amazing view.
I hope so.
of the castle. Yeah.
Yeah. We're really hoping for the good weather.
Yeah.
And lovely. It goes really quickly as well. It's 10K, but doesn't feel like it because you're just walking along and chat.
No, I think I had about 5 coffees. She was walking around. I was with my dad and we watched her and I was just like, probably felt quite quick for you, but you guys were doing it for quite some time. Like, it wasn't fast. It is a walk. And I think from...
Yeah, you almost have to train for it as well.
Oh, yeah. You definitely would need to do a couple of walks. Otherwise, you just get cramped, don't you? So it helps to have a couple of walks. It's not that kind of, oh, come and give me a fundraiser. This is so easy. No, you really have to work a bit hard for it. And that's why it's worth giving some fundraising and stuff for the person that's doing it, ultimately going to the charity.
Definitely.
But yeah, it's not easy. Like that's why I didn't do it. I was like, I can't do it. I didn't have the energy to do it. But
yeah, physically very demanding. Yeah. So it doesn't feel it at first because you're walking quite happily and it feels quite normal. But after about 8 kilometers, it sinks in a bit and you start feeling a bit
slower.
Knackered.
Yeah, you're a bit slower and you're like, oh my gosh, I just want to get to the end. But when you get to the end, when you get to the end, you get this massive like cheer from the people that are already there, and you've got all of the charity stewards there, or is it stewards? Yeah, stewards, where they're all kind of ringing bells and all sorts, isn't it? It's a really good feeling. It's a nice experience.
It's a lovely feeling. You feel really celebrated. And at the London one last year, there was obviously the big sort of blow up balloon gate and you walk back to it and it's a big sort of celebration. But then you walk into the kind of center where everyone, you know, ticks off and gets their medals and everything, all the admin were in there cheering as well. So it was really lovely.
Thank you very much.
Lovely. Oh, thank you. Thank you for chatting with me. Bye.
This is the Auntie Anne Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie Anne Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.